Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We have a great lineup of guests today. David Frum, Paul Krugman, Nassim Taleb, and Lenore Skenazy. You know Lenore Skenazy? She's the one who's suggesting that tomorrow be Leave Your Kid Alone in the Park Day. So she'll be on later, but that's after David Frum, Paul Krugman, and Nassim Taleb, author of The Black Swan. We'll get to David Frum in just a minute, and then Paul Krugman. Now, Rand Paul may have just stumbled onto his Waterloo, a segregated lunch counter in the Old South. The newly minted Republican/Tea Party nominee for the U.S. Senate said this to Rachel Maddow on MSNBC Wednesday night.
There's 10 different titles, you know, to the Civil Rights Act, and 9 out of 10 deal with public institutions, and I'm absolutely in favor of. One deals with private institutions, and had I been around, I would have tried to modify that. The thing is if we want to harbor in on private businesses and their policies, then you have to have the discussion about, do you want to abridge the First Amendment as well?
So Rand Paul's brand of libertarianism extends all the way to being on the wrong side of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 when it comes to private sector discrimination. Game on for the general election. One of Rand Paul's biggest detractors in the conservative movement is the author, blogger, and former Bush speechwriter David Frum, author of books including Dead Right, An End to Evil, and Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. He is editor of From Forum Online. And David, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Your top blog post today on From Forum predicts that not just the candidate, but the whole Republican Party will pay a price for Rand Paul's gaffe. Why do you think that's true?
Well, I mean, the whole thing is so maddening, I have to say. I've compared this to the man who appeared on Rachel Maddow, and his job was to walk across an empty room and not trip. And what he did is he stepped out of the room, into the hall, pulled out a vacuum cleaner, plugged it in, stretched the cord, raced backwards, charged forward, and tripped and broke his nose. I mean, how you turn the 1964 Civil Rights Act into a ballot question in 2010, I do not understand. Why you feel the need to do it, I don't understand. Why you can't give the answer that has been the unanimous answer of the society for a half century, I don't understand. But now the game's up, right? I mean, that he is somebody who's drawn a lot of support. Sarah Palin endorsed him. Jim DeMint endorsed him. Other prominent conservative Republicans have endorsed as well. And they're going to now be asked this same question, which is not exactly a live controversy in a year when we have no shortage of live controversies.
And your headline calls it Rand Paul's gaffe. But it really wasn't a gaffe, was it? If gaffe means some kind of mistake or aberration, it's part of his core belief system.
Well, I'm not very happy with the Paul family approach to a lot of these questions. I think in their case, yes, it does emerge. The father's, not quite sure that the right side won the Civil War. This is not libertarianism as most modern libertarians understand it, which is a philosophy of limiting the government, maximizing personal freedom, enabling personal choice in financial and personal areas. Those are powerful values in this modern age, and that Republicans can very effectively stand up for. Misplaced nostalgia for the vanished South, no.
Does this issue go to the larger critique that you have of Rand Paul and some of his other positions, like that the federal government should not have drug laws and that a nuclear Iran poses no threat to the United States?
Well, he comes out of a very narrow subset of the conservative and even libertarian world, and I think a lot of his foreign policy ideas are pretty out there as well. This is a year that Republicans should be standing to make a lot of gains, but the temptation in a year when the wind is behind you is to go with, to talk about yourself, to talk to your base. And I think there's a real lesson here to be learned from what the Democrats did in 2006, which was a year that they had the wind at their backs. They didn't try to nominate the most extreme liberal Democrats they could in 2006. That was the year that they got behind people like John Tester in Montana and said, we are going to go into states where we've had trouble in the past, where we have an opportunity to now find people who speak to those states. Broaden our definition of what it means to be a Democrat, find a room in the Democratic Party for gun owners, for example. Well, we should be doing the same thing in 2010. Use this opportunity to broaden the party, not narrow it.
It's interesting. You talk about the wind at the Republicans' backs. I assume that Rand Paul would have been unelectable in almost any statewide race before the financial crisis, not to mention in a Republican primary. Do you think the United States is that different a country now than it was 2 years ago that Paul has been able to get this far?
Well, let's not assume that he is electable even in this year. And this is one of the other concerns I have about this
Well,
nomination.
He did win that nomination statewide.
He won that, yes. The Democrats had a nomination fight on the same day. The loser of the Democratic fight got 15,000 more votes than Rand Paul did. The winner got 20,000 more votes. Half a million people voted in the Democratic primary. A quarter of a million people voted in the Republican primary. So that is a little troubling to me. And that is, but I think that's right. I mean, in a different year, I don't know that you would have been able to go very far with a candidate like Rand Paul. But this is exactly the year when so many people are concerned about the overreach of the Obama administration, about overspending, overtaxing, over debt, to start saying, you know, I bet we can find a lot of women who share those concerns. I bet we can find a lot of Hispanics and African Americans who share those concerns. Let us look for the Republican John Tester, and let's look for him. I mean, I think we found a little bit of an example of that with Scott Brown in Massachusetts, but there must be such people in New York, in Minnesota, Delaware. In Delaware, we are going to do it. And let's use this as our broadening moment.
David Frum, my guest on WNYC, editor of Frum Forum, as well as author of books including Dead Right, An End to Evil, and Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Let me ask you a little bit about the recent controversy surrounding you and your own place in American conservatism. You've been saying things like that 20 years ago, conservatism offered something more than Rush Limbaugh. Since then, the conservative elite has collapsed. And we used to think Fox News worked for the Republican Party. Now we discover that the Republican Party works for Fox News. Do I have those quotes right?
Yes, I think that's right.
And so what are you trying to say?
Well, look, what I'm trying to say is if the Republicans do well, we're going to have a program. And maybe in a 2010 election, you don't need a positive program. But if you're going to run for president, and actually if you're going to then exercise majority power, you need a program. We don't have one, and to the extent we have one, it's left over from the 1970s. So we have a lot of good ideas about how to defeat the Soviet Union. We've got a lot of good ideas about how to stop crime in urban centers, and we've got good ideas about how to stop inflation. Those are, and they remain all valid ideas if the problems were there, but they're not. Today's problems are sluggish growth from a financial crisis, the rising cost of health care as a share of the national economy, an increasingly unfavorable international situation caused by the decline in strength of many of our traditional allies. These are the areas where we need to apply some new ideas. And the program that we had in 1980, right as it was for that time, is not right now. And yet the inventory is not being replenished. And indeed, we have these choke points in the conservative media and talk radio and Fox TV that exist to short-circuit a lot of debate. I mean, when I was my go-round with Fox and talk began about 18 months ago when this debate was all happening in sort of milder form, and Rush Limbaugh went to CPAC, the annual conservative convention, in February of 2009 and pronounced an anathema on people like myself and David Brooks and Ross Douthat, who now writes for the New York Times, and his co-writer, Raheem Salon, who said, we need some new ideas. And he said, we can't tolerate this. This is the kind of thinking with which, you know, that must be stamped out, his phrase, in the party. And that, I thought, was kind of an unpromising route to the future.
On health reform, you wrote, we followed the most radical voices in the party and the movement, and they led us to abject and irreversible defeat. And then according to accounts that I've read in the press, you were fired for that from your position at the American Enterprise Institute think tank. Were you fired from AEI for being an apostate?
Well, let me AEI will say I was not fired because I was offered the option of continuing to have an affiliation with the institution. However, they were going to take away my office, my salary, my health plan, my pension. So it depends on what you mean by – I mean, I was welcome to work for free from home. And under the circumstances, I thought, you know, why don't you just take my resignation?
And it's curious that this comes up, and I hadn't been following this controversy. I literally did not know about this until yesterday, after yesterday's show when we had Ayaan Hirsi Ali, currently a fellow at AEI, and she is the original inspiration, among many other things that she's done, for everyone Draw Muhammad Day yesterday to, you know, speak back to the rioters over cartoons and things like that. And I asked why someone with a feminist secular agenda works for a conservative think tank, and she said this.
The American Enterprise Institute is progressive, depending on how you define the word progressive. What we do at the American Enterprise is we all think about current day issues, all the thinkers there, and you come up with ideas on how you think government government policy should be directed or should not be directed. Those ideas are open for debate. It's not a church. We don't all need to agree with one another.
So in your experience, maybe not so tolerant of intellectual diversity?
Well, let me say, Ayaan is a close personal friend, and I, of course, am not going to dissent from anything that she wants to say. And I think it's a fabulous thing. I mean, that AEI is there for Ayaan, and I think it is actually quite a telling comment on a lot of other American institutions that at a moment when she was in physical jeopardy and was a refugee, that it was AEI and not anybody else who found a way not only to give her an institutional base, but also to get her into the country, where AEI was instrumental in getting Ayaan permission to reside in the United States. And that, I think, is one of the institution's finest hours. You know, I think I'm proud to be associated with her. That said, Ayaan does not work on U.S. domestic policy. I mean, she is an expert on the problem the world faces from Islamic extremism. I think on that ground, there would be unanimous opinion at AEI, and I would join that unanimous opinion. On U.S. domestic policy, however, and especially in the past year, things have become a little bit more difficult, and that relates, I think, to some of the institutional pressures in the conservative world. It's harder to raise money. The donors are more assertive. And whatever people who run institutions would like to do, they operate in an environment of constraint where they have donors who have strong views and that they can't be ignored.
So maybe we need an everyone draw Rush Limbaugh day, you think?
I think conservatives are going to need to develop some new policy ideas to govern the country, and if Republicans gain a majority in the House in 2010, it's going to become a very urgent problem. If we can wait till 2012, it will be a less urgent problem. But what do we do with health care consuming 17% of GDP and consuming 13% in the runner-up, Switzerland? If the United States spent as little on health care or as much on health care as Switzerland does, it would be like getting the defense budget for free.
David Frum, editor of Frum Forum Online, author of books including Dead Right, An End to Evil, and Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. David, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Paul Krugman next. Stay with us.